What do you know about the murder of Elaine Doyle?
Nothing other than what I've read.
During the 1980s, forensic science was still in its early stages, lacking the advanced techniques we have today. However, over the subsequent couple of decades, remarkable strides were made in the field. DNA testing, fingerprint analysis, and fiber testing emerged, ushering in a new era of forensic capabilities. With these breakthroughs, cold cases that had long remained unsolved began to be revisited, utilising the power of modern investigative techniques. Elaine Doyle was born in 1970, the only daughter of Jack and Maureen Doyle. The Doyle family made their home at 28 Ardgowan Street in Greenock, residing in a three-storey terrace house converted into flats. Their home was conveniently situated not far from the local amenities and a short distance away from the bustling docks. Jack worked as a postman, diligently delivering mail while Maureen was employed at a nearby bedding shop. Elaine was the apple of their eyes, and she took her initial steps towards independence after completing her schooling. She began working as a shop assistant at a local jewellery store. During her school years, Elaine had effortlessly formed friendships that endured. One of her closest friends, Claire McGarity, fondly remembered her saying, "She was such a happy girl." Elaine was very trusting. Others in her circle referred to her as a guardian angel, given her propensity for prioritizing her friends' needs over her own. These friendships held immense significance for Elaine, as demonstrated by her Snoopy notebook, where she penned heartfelt sentiments. One of them read, "One of the best things in the whole world is a friend," while another read, "Friends are made for hugging." Like many girls in the area, Elaine enjoyed spending time with her friends in the town. Due to her proximity to the town centre, she frequently walked home alone. Jack and Maureen, while uneasy about their daughter walking home solo, especially at night, recognised the importance of granting her some freedom. Jack remembered his daughter as sensible, having warned her about the dangers of late-night walks and the importance of avoiding interactions with strangers. He described her as a girl who was brimming with life, a girl who never broke a promise. Elaine herself was cautious about stranger danger. She had confided in her friends that she had been followed by a man in a car on a few occasions. These unsettling incidents had left her on edge, prompting her to always have a male friend accompany her on her journey home when out with friends. Elaine shared a close bond with her parents, and she also had an older brother, John. While Elaine and John cherished their sibling connection, he couldn't help but see her as his occasionally annoying little sister, but he described her as annoying in a cute way. Maureen emphasized the love and affection that surrounded Elaine throughout her life, and this love and affection was always reciprocated. She recollected, "She was a nice wee girl who needed a lot of love and cuddles, even at 16. Maureen also characterised her daughter as sweet and considerate, noting, "She was never a tomboy, always a girly girl." On the evening of the 1st of June 1986, in Greenock, there was an excitement in the air. A local late-night disco was in full swing at the Celtic Supporters Club, and 16-year-old Elaine had eagerly planned to attend with three of her girlfriends. It marked her first venture into the world of grown-up discos, and she was thrilled. For this special night, Elaine donned a stylish black and white floral dress, paired with a blue leather jacket. Before leaving her home, she made a promise to her father, Jack. She assured him that she would call him to let him know that she was safe. At about 8:30 p.m, Elaine fulfilled her promise and she gave her father a call from the disco. She told him that she was having a great time and she would be home no later than 12:30 a.m. Jack later recollected, "I told her to be careful and watch herself." Just past midnight, Elaine and her three friends left the club and made their way to a nearby hamburger stall in Cathcart Street. The area was bustling with young people, taking advantage of the upcoming public holiday by enjoying the night out. They struck up a conversation with a group of other teenagers by the hamburger stall and were offered a ride home by a friend's brother. However, the lift wouldn't be available until 1 a.m. Elaine had made a promise to her father that she couldn't break, so the decision was made for Elaine to walk home alone. She bid her friends farewell and embarked on the 3/4 of a mile journey back to her family's home. Lynn Ryan, her friend, chased after her, desperately trying to persuade her to wait until 1 a.m. to get the lift back home. Lynn even offered Elaine a place to stay overnight, as it was becoming much too late to be walking home alone. However, Elaine didn't want to cause any unnecessary worry for her parents. Lynn later lamented, "I always wish I had persuaded her." Elaine's journey home would have taken her approximately 20 minutes. A few hundred yards into her walk, she encountered two friends on Hamilton Way. She paused to engage in a brief conversation with them before resuming her journey, her path illuminated by the gentle glow of streetlights. In the early hours of the next morning, Jack prepared for his early morning shift as a postman. To his surprise, when he checked Elaine's bedroom, she was nowhere to be found. Her bed remained untouched, leading him to conclude that she likely spent the night at a friend's house, most likely Lynn's. Jack reached out to Lynn, inquiring whether Elaine had stayed over. The moment he learned that she had walked home alone, an overwhelming sense of dread washed over him. Around the same time, a man strolled along a leafy lane, situated about 25 yards away from Elaine's front door. His intention was to unlock one of his garages, located down the lane, when he noticed something in the near distance. As he drew closer, he was horrified to discover the lifeless body of a teenage girl. It was Elaine Doyle. She was partially nude and had been sexually assaulted and then strangled to death with a ligature. Nearby, her clothes were lying in a neat pile. Detectives swiftly arrived at the scene, cordoning it off with crime scene tape as they launched an investigation. Nearby, Jack and Maureen became aware of the commotion unfolding outside of their home. With growing concern and frantic worry, they ventured outside and approached one of the detectives, seeking answers. Upon hearing that a girl's lifeless body had been discovered, an instinctual dread washed over them. A parent's intuition. In those times, DNA analysis had yet to be developed, but the detectives at the scene meticulously searched for any fibers that might have clung to Elaine. They employed white adhesive tape to recover any potential traces from Elaine's body, carefully affixing them to transparent sheets for preservation. Signs of a struggle in the form of hair were found near Elaine's body. The investigation was headed by Detective Chief Superintendent John Fleming, who commented in the media, "Obviously, we would be foolish to disregard any link between this killing and the Bluebell Woods murder, but we are not connecting the two at the moment." He was referring to the murder of 20-year-old Alison Murray, who had been found dead 10 days earlier in Bluebell Woods, near her home in Drumchapel, Glasgow. Detectives scanned the neighbourhood, searching for Elaine's missing handbag, a blue clutch bag that she was known to have been carrying when she parted ways with her friends. In times of uncertainty, it's crucial to be prepared. Many people worry about the possibility of enduring prolonged periods without essential resources, such as electricity or even food. That's why I'm excited to introduce you to 4patriots.com, your one-stop destination for reliable preparedness products that not only serve your immediate needs, but also have the potential to safeguard your life in the face of adversity. One product that stands out is 4patriots' latest solar generator, the Patriot Power Generator 2000X. Harnessing the boundless free energy of the sun, this generator can power various essentials, from lights and television to crucial medical equipment and even refrigeration. What's more, it's expandable and comes with a complimentary solar panel. You can also explore 4 Patriot's best-selling survival food kits, crafted for a shelf life of 25 years, ensuring both sustenance and peace of mind. These delicious-tasting meals can be easily prepared even in the absence of electricity. Simply boil water over an open fire, let it simmer, and serve. To ensure you don't miss out on this week's exclusive discounts and deals, I've arranged for a special page dedicated to listeners of Morbidology at 4patriots.com/morbidology. Head over now to take advantage of these offers before they disappear. Go to 4patriots.com/morbidology, but hurry, these deals won't last long. Save money and get peace of mind now by going to 4patriots.com/morbidology. News of Elaine's murder spread rapidly throughout the area, leaving residents deeply unsettled. The spectre of an opportunistic killer lurked in their midst, weighing heavily on the community, causing women and girls to fear venturing out alone. One local father remarked, "This place was reckoned to be safe by everyone, until now." Detectives began to conduct door-to-door inquiries with Elaine's neighbours. They wanted to establish whether anybody had seen or heard anything suspicious that night that could aid in the investigation. A couple of neighbours reported seeing a group of 5 youths in Elaine's street at about 1 a.m. Meanwhile, John and Maureen were distraught beyond reconciliation. They went to stay with family and received support from the community. George and Anne Porter had some words of wisdom for them, telling them, "Keep hoping and praying your daughter's killer will be caught." Their daughter, Lorna, had been found dead with her throat slashed on Waste Grand in Bells Hill, Lanarkshire, in 1984. She had been on her way home to nearby Hollytown from her boyfriend's home when the killer struck. Lorna's killer was still on the loose at the time, and Anne commented, "We know what the parents of Elaine are feeling right now. It's hell." On June 6th, detectives reached out to the public for assistance in their ongoing investigation. They were still in search of Elaine's missing handbag and requested the community's cooperation in keeping an eye out for it. Their efforts remained focused on reconstructing Elaine's last known movements. They knew she had left her friends at the hamburger stall around midnight to begin her journey back home. Tragically, Elaine was intercepted by her killer not far from her front door. The very next day, a tip from the public emerged. According to the tipster, they had witnessed a girl who resembled Elaine boarding a taxi shortly after midnight on Cathcart Street. Detectives appealed to the public for additional information on this sighting, urging anybody else who may have witnessed this incident to come forward. They emphasised that the person getting into the taxi may not have been Elaine, underlining the need to establish further details. By now, the 5 teenagers seen in the neighbourhood around 1 a.m. still hadn't come forward, and detectives once more appealed for information about the youths. While still trying to track down these teenagers and Elaine's handbag, a woman placed a phone call to a Citizens Advice Bureau in Greenock. She said that she had vital information about Elaine's murder, but hung up without providing her name or that information. On June 10th, detectives placed an advertisement in the Daily Record, requesting the woman to call back, but unfortunately, she never did. Undeterred, detectives continued to press forward with their investigation. On June 14th, Elaine's father, Jack, joined forces with Ian Murray, the father of Alison Murray, to make a heartfelt plea for information. They came together and pleaded, "Please help find our daughter's killers." Jack said that meeting Ian had helped to make the pain of losing his daughter that little bit more bearable. He stated, "We've been able to talk over our hurt and remember our girls the way they should be remembered, as happy, loving daughters." The following month, Jack and Maureen were home when their phone began to ring. Jack answered, and on the other end of the line they heard the voice of an unfamiliar woman. Amidst sobs, she revealed that she had information regarding their daughter's killer, before abruptly disconnecting the phone call. Just a couple of days later, this same woman composed a letter addressed to Jack, offering details about Elaine's murder. However, Jack never received any further communication from her. Consequently, detectives issued a public appeal for the unknown woman to come forward. Detective John Fleming described her as frightened and emphasized the importance of speaking to her. Detectives continued their relentless efforts on the investigation. By the end of July, they had interviewed more than 2,000 individuals and taken over 1,000 statements. However, Elaine's killer still remained elusive. Despite a few incoming tips, the lack of information provided by the public left detectives and Elaine's loved ones disheartened. The five teenagers still hadn't come forward to identify themselves to detectives, nor had anybody else who may have been able to identify them. Detective Fleming commented, "There were five youths seen walking near Elaine's home shortly after midnight on the night she died. No one has come forward, despite repeated appeals. They could have vital information. There was also a young couple who had been seen walking in the area around the same time. But despite pleas for them to come forward, they still hadn't." That same month, detectives learned of three other assaults on women. These women didn't initially come forward to detectives, but when they did, they said they didn't think that their attacks were of any significance. The first woman had been attacked just a few hundred yards away from where Elaine was attacked, and just 12 days later. The year beforehand, two other young women had been attacked in the vicinity, and detectives began to wonder whether the attacks were connected. Detective Fleming announced, "We urgently need the cooperation of the public to track down this man before he is given the opportunity to strike again." What interested detectives were the similarities between the four attacks. All four women had been attacked in the same area, at the weekend, and at about 1 a.m. Other than Elaine, however, all other women survived the attacks, although with psychological scars that would last a lifetime. While investigating these potentially linked cases, detectives received a fresh lead. According to the informant, they had witnessed the individual responsible for Elaine's murder fleeing from the crime scene. The suspect was estimated to be somewhere between 20 to 30 years old, with a height ranging from approximately 5 feet 6 inches tall to 5 feet 7 inches tall. He was observed running down Ardgowan Street towards West Shaw Street, ultimately vanishing from view. The individual was dressed in dark outerwear, complemented by a light or white shirt protruding from his trousers. The tipster noted that the suspect appeared to be disheveled and agitated. Subsequently, two more tips reached the detectives. These callers reported encountering a young man displaying signs of agitation, roughly 500 yards away from where Elaine's body was discovered, around 1 a.m. that night. These witnesses described the individual as approximately 19 to 22 years old, with short red or auburn hair. He stood at a height ranging from about 5 feet 5 inches tall to 7 inches, sporting a medium build. His complexion was pale and his facial features possibly included freckles. The man was dressed in a dark-coloured jumper, dark trousers and a light-coloured shirt. Detectives now had a good description of the man they believed to have killed Elaine. In early August, they turned to the public and asked for more assistance in helping to identify him. They provided a description and asked people to name anybody that sounded similar to the description. Then on the 19th of August, they released a composite sketch of the suspect in question. Detective Fleming announced, "It is absolutely imperative that we trace this man." By the next day, detectives had received almost 100 names of men who looked like the composite sketch. However, the glimmer of hope that the case could be cracked began to fade when detectives couldn't tie any of the men to the murder of Elaine. The investigation plodded on, but the tips began to dwindle. By November, more than 20 weeks had passed, but detectives were no closer to finding the killer than they were on day one.
Have you ever found yourself tirelessly searching for a new doctor, reaching out to every single person you know for their trusted recommendation? You know, the kind of doctor who not only listens attentively to your concerns, but also puts you at ease and truly comprehends your needs. After what feels like endless weeks of searching, just when you think you've found the perfect match, you realize that they don't accept your insurance. Fret not, for I have found the perfect solution for you. ZocDoc. With thousands of highly rated doctors, each accompanied by verified patient reviews, ZocDoc is the answer to your predicament. ZocDoc is a free app where you can find amazing doctors and book appointments online. We're talking about booking appointments with thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed doctors and specialists. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat almost any condition you're searching for. If I was searching for a doctor, ZocDoc would have been absolutely perfect for me. Go to ZocDoc.com/morbidology and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/morbidology, ZocDoc.com/morbidology. On the 5th of that month, a reward was put forward by a group of anonymous businessmen from the same area. It was a four-figure reward, but the exact amount wasn't disclosed. Detective Fleming was surprised by the reward fund, but pleased. He stated, "It is uncommon in Scotland to offer rewards of this nature, but it is one we welcome." He said that he had little doubt that somebody in the area was withholding vital information, but hoped that the reward would lure them out. The investigation was hampered by a lack of leads. After Elaine left her girlfriends at the hamburger stall, there hadn't been any other reported sightings of her. At least not yet, anyway. However, it was believed that somebody somewhere must have seen her as she trekked back home alone. One more important tip came into detectives around the same time. According to a man, he had seen Elaine walking on Ardgowan Street. He observed a man following her, and at one stage she appeared to argue with him. According to the eyewitness, he said something to the man and asked the girl whether she was okay, but he was told by the man to mind his own business. He told detectives that he put it down to a lover's tiff and left it at that, but he was sure that the girl was Elaine. It was a decision that he would come to regret for the rest of his life. Christmas came and went, but it was a somber event for the Doyle family. Elaine's mother, Maureen, spent the entire Christmas week in bed crying. She solemnly commented, "I couldn't bring myself to enjoy Christmas without my little girl." In February, Detective Fleming spoke with the Daily Record. He shared his belief that Elaine's killer was a local man, and that somebody within the community was shielding him. During the Mammoth murder inquiry, detectives had interviewed around 5,000 people and had taken an additional 3,500 statements. However, nobody could offer any further insight into Elaine's murder. Jack commented that he wasn't bitter over the lack of public response, commenting, "If someone has information about Elaine's killer and hasn't come forward, I can only assume it's through fear." He said that he and Maureen had been inundated by letters and phone calls of condolences from people throughout the area. He didn't feel as though people weren't necessarily coming forward because they didn't want to, but because they had no information or were scared. In March, Jack and Maureen went to their daughter's grave and found 10 carnations. Two of them were crossed in the shape of a kiss. Perplexed by this find, they reached out to Elaine's close friends and family, but nobody could provide any explanation for the presence of the flowers. Concerned and curious, they promptly reported the matter to detectives, who showed a keen interest. The possibility that Elaine's killer might have left these carnations intrigued the detectives, prompting them to reach out to the public for any potential leads. They also conducted inquiries at local florists and garden centres in the vicinity, hoping to gather some information about the origin of the flowers. While looking into this, another disturbing incident took place less than a mile away from where Elaine was killed. Two teenage girls were on their way back home from a disco class when a man attacked them in Larkfield Road. One girl managed to struggle free and stagger to a nearby home, where police were called to the scene.
The second girl was discovered dazed in a nearby cemetery. Detectives considered the possibility that Elaine's killer was the same man who had attacked the two teenage girls, putting a dark cloud over the coastal town. Then in June, Jack and Maureen spoke with the Daily Record about the immense loss of their daughter. Maureen poignantly stated, "Time isn't such a great healer. Everybody keeps telling me this, but I feel as lost and confused today as I did the night Elaine didn't come home." They were both deeply religious and said that they didn't want vengeance against their daughter's killer. Instead, they just wanted to see him arrested to prevent any other parents from going through the same horrific ordeal as them. Jack commented, "Why would anyone want to harm a girl like that? Knowing the answer wouldn't lessen our grief, but it might help us to understand." Over time, the months gradually transformed into years, and the case grew colder with each passing day. Detectives diligently pursued every tip they received, but none proved to be fruitful. A potential lead emerged in March of 1995, coinciding with the conviction of James Morrow from Greenock, who had perpetrated a brutal assault on a young mother, resulting in a 14-year prison sentence. Morrow had faced accusations of assaulting two girls in Greenock back in 1987, but he had been acquitted of those charges. Upon Morrow's conviction, detectives announced their intention to question him regarding Elaine's murder. He had been residing in the area at the time of her death, and the similarities between his crimes and her murder were striking. Nevertheless, detectives swiftly eliminated him as a suspect. In 2005, a significant breakthrough occurred when it was announced that Elaine's handbag had been discovered. Detectives chose not to disclose the exact date of the discovery, but confirmed that it was now undergoing examination. Since 1986, forensic testing had advanced significantly, incorporating DNA profiling, fiber analysis, and more modern fingerprinting technology. A senior officer acknowledged this development, remarking, "It is an extremely significant breakthrough, perhaps the single most important development in this tragic case for many, many years." Additionally, detectives now had access to modern computer software, enabling them to input all evidence, including statements, into the computer system, which would then provide them with valuable investigative leads. In June 2006, Jack and Maureen made an emotional plea to help catch their daughter's killer. It was the first time that they had spoken on Elaine's murder in years, but the passage of time had done very little to alleviate their grief. It had now been 20 years since Elaine was killed, but Jack and Maureen said it seemed like just yesterday that she was taken from them. They stated, "Elaine is always spoken about with great affection, and people still say to us the town has never been the same since. Our family knows how important it is to help the police in every way possible. We appeal to everyone in the town to provide the police with information they need to solve the crime. When this happens, we will be able to grieve peacefully, and then the town will also be able to move on, knowing that justice has been done." In that same year, it was revealed that DNA testing on Elaine's handbag had yielded male DNA. Further revelations disclosed that the handbag had been found just a week after Elaine's murder, intentionally placed on the steps of the Witt Memorial Library Museum in Greenock and partially subjected to burning. Whoever had left it there seemed to have a clear intention of ensuring its discovery. Detectives entertained two possibilities. Either the killer had left it there to taunt the detectives, or somebody else had been tasked with destroying it. Detective Inspector Ross McKay commented, "This is the first time we have revealed that someone attempted to burn Elaine's bag, and we are hoping that will jog someone's memory somewhere. Perhaps it was the killer or someone he had asked to get rid of the bag. But we are hoping that a member of the public will remember the attempts to burn a blue bag. It's the type of incident that just might stick out in someone's mind." Remarkably, nothing had been stolen from the handbag, leading detectives to speculate that it might have been taken as a grim keepsake by Elaine's killer. In addition to this DNA profile, male DNA had also been recovered from Elaine's body, from her face and back. This male DNA profile was subsequently run through a national database, but no matches were found, implying that the killer hadn't been apprehended for any other crime since the database's inception. Detectives embarked on the arduous task of revisiting the 3,000 individuals who had originally been questioned during the investigation, collecting their DNA samples for analysis. Detective McKay acknowledged the painstaking nature of this process, stating, "We are 100% confident we will solve this crime. It is there to be solved. DNA is a fantastic investigative tool for us. I'm sure we're going to have a success with it." As detectives commenced this rigorous undertaking, Elaine's friend, Lynn, who had accompanied her to the disco that night, decided to break her long-standing silence. She shared the immense difficulty she had experienced since Elaine's murder, stating, "That night, whoever killed Elaine took part of my heart too, and my life as well." Lynn revealed that she had developed agoraphobia and continued to feel helpless even 2 decades later. While detectives now possessed the killer's DNA sample, they grappled with the challenge of matching it to a suspect. The years dragged on. By 2011, detectives turned to a modern tactic, familial DNA testing. This meant that they could search through DNA databases for any matches that were similar to the killer's DNA, whether that be from a child or some other kind of relative. They had set up a new team to investigate the case, Operation Evergreen, and they began a mass screening exercise, collecting DNA samples from thousands of people in tandem with familial DNA analysis. They appealed to the public and asked that if anybody had harboured any kind of suspicions about anybody in the past, to reach out. In June of 2011, the 25th anniversary of Elaine's murder arrived, prompting her father Jack to speak publicly on the occasion. He voiced his heartfelt hope that the renewed investigation could, at long last, deliver justice for his daughter. The weight of 25 years of grief was evident on Jack's face, as he emphasised that both the family and Elaine herself deserved justice. Jack conveyed his feelings, stating, "Time has not healed the wounds. The passage of time teaches you to cope with the heartbreak. But as any parent who has lost a child will know, the pain Maureen and I feel on a daily basis is as real as when we first received that awful news." Later in the same month, a televised reconstruction of Elaine's murder was featured on Crime Watch. Detectives reported that the response to the programme was encouraging, resulting in numerous tips and the identification of persons of interest. Among these leads were 6 individuals who now lived in Australia, prompting Scottish detectives to seek assistance from Interpol. That same year, a man who identified himself as Alexander Cannon appeared at Greenock Police Station. He appeared to be agitated and bluntly stated, "I want to confess to the murder of Elaine Doyle." He said that he had met her at a health centre near her home in Ardgowan Street. However, this health centre wasn't built until years after Elaine was killed. Detectives ruled him out of the investigation. In January of 2012, the Doyle family endured yet another devastating tragedy when Elaine's 17-year-old nephew, Jack Doyle, was fatally stabbed in Greenock. Born years after Elaine's murder, this was a heart-wrenching coincidence for the family. A family member expressed their shock, stating, "My family are deeply shocked by what has happened, and we're trying to come to terms with it." Ultimately, a 19-year-old named Stephen McIntyre was convicted of Jack's murder, but Elaine's killer continued to elude justice. However, time was slowly catching up on him. Among the names of persons of interest in the case was a man named John Dougherty. He had been a resident of the area during the time Elaine was killed, and he had been out with friends on that night. At the time, he was far from being a suspect. Rather, he was merely one among many males in the area who piqued the detective's curiosity. In March of 2012, detectives paid a visit to Dougherty's flat in the heart of Trafalgar Square in Greenock, located less than a mile away from where Elaine had resided all those decades earlier. Doherty was cooperative, willingly providing a DNA sample, his fingerprints, and even consenting to being photographed. These collected samples were dispatched to the crime lab in Dundee for analysis. Detectives were left stunned when the results returned, revealing that Doherty's DNA was a perfect match to the genetic material discovered at the crime scene. On the 22nd of March, 48-year-old John Doherty was taken into custody in connection with Elaine's murder. Tragically, Elaine's father Jack was no longer alive to witness the groundbreaking development. He had died from cancer the year beforehand. He had persevered with unwavering hope that one day, his daughter's killer would be found. Martin Brown, the witness who had spotted someone shadowing Elaine on the night she was killed, unequivocally identified Doherty from a lineup as the man he had seen. However, despite the damning DNA evidence against him, Doherty professed ignorance about Elaine's murder when he was arrested, asserting that his knowledge was limited to what he had read in the newspapers.
What do you know about the murder of Elaine Doyle?
Nothing other than what I've read.
Tell me what you've read.
Local newspapers, young girl, night out, murdered on the way home.
During his interview with detectives, he first of all claimed he couldn't remember where he was the night Elaine was killed. However, he then admitted that he was at the same disco as her. He said that he had danced with a couple of girls, one of whom could have been Elaine, but he wasn't sure. When told he was identified as the man seen following Elaine near her home, he replied, "I wasn't in that neck of the woods." While Doherty was booked into jail on a murder charge, detectives returned to his flat. Here, they came across two copies of a newspaper story about Elaine's murder. At the time of Elaine's murder, John Doherty was a 22-year-old residing with his parents on Ann Street in Greenock. He had left school at 16, worked as a labourer in the yards for a period, experienced bouts of unemployment, and participated in government work programmes. Back in 1986, he was engaged to a woman named Linda Hargey. When news of Elaine's murder began circulating throughout the area, Linda couldn't help but wonder why Doherty hadn't responded to the police appeal. Detectives had called on everybody who'd been at the club that night to come forward, and it struck Linda as peculiar that Doherty had refrained from doing so. Linda knew for certain that he had been at the club that night, and her inquiry about his silence triggered an alarming reaction. Doherty erupted into a furious rage, shoving Linda against a wall and vehemently instructing her to never bring up the matter again. Their relationship was characterised by volatility and experienced numerous on-and-off phases. In the following year, 1987, Doherty embarked on an unexpected 6-year journey with the Army, a decision that perplexed his friends and family. Joining the armed forces had never been on his radar before. After Elaine's murder, Doherty had withdrawn from socialising with friends, and he eventually vanished from the scene to join the army. Upon his return to civilian life, his relationship with Linda had soured, leading to their separation. Doherty secured a position with the local authority, a job he continued to hold at the time of his eventual arrest. The day after Doherty was arrested, he faced charges of both murder and theft. Despite these serious accusations, Doherty was granted bail and released from jail. In January the next year, he was formally indicted on the murder charge, and he was ordered to stand trial. In the subsequent month, Doherty appeared in court and entered a plea of not guilty to the murder charge. Halloween has always been my favourite time of the year. I take pride in decking out my home with spooky decorations, from light-up pumpkins and skeletons to candles emitting those quintessential fall scents. Yet one thing I can't stand is the struggle to locate my stash of Halloween decorations. If you can relate, here's the ideal solution: Smart Labels. With Smart Labels, you can effortlessly catalogue your storage bins using their user-friendly app and QR code stickers. This means you'll always know which bin contains what, from the label's colour to the unique code. Just search for Halloween on their app and hey presto, it will tell you exactly what storage bin your decorations are in. Alternatively, you can scan the QR code on your storage bin to instantly access a detailed inventory of its contents. Say goodbye to spending endless minutes rummaging through bins. Get straight to decorating this holiday season. To begin, just visit qrsmartlabels.com or check out Amazon or Walmart for their convenient QR labels. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play to simplify your storage management. Say hello to hassle-free decorating with Smart Labels. The murder trial commenced on March 28th, with Doherty's defense attorney, Donald Finley, asserting that his client was not responsible for the murder, but instead blamed someone else. They presented a special defense of incrimination, suggesting that the actual killer could be among a list of names derived from the investigation. Defense attorney Finley read aloud 41 separate names of other persons of interest who had been looked into during the investigation. In contrast, the prosecution maintained that John Doherty was indeed Elaine's killer. They alleged that he had forcibly grabbed Elaine by the hair while she was walking home, struck her on the head, and either removed or compelled her to remove her clothing. Subsequently, he forced her to the ground, pressed her face into the earth, sat or knelt on her, and used a ligature to strangle her. During the trial, the jury was presented with details about the discovery of Elaine's body and the findings from her autopsy. Detective William Kennedy testified about his presence at the crime scene and his role in placing a blanket over Elaine's body. When defense attorney Finley inquired about his knowledge of crime scene contamination at the time, Kennedy responded, "Next to nothing, to be honest." It became evident that the defense team were trying to lay the groundwork to argue that the crime scene may have been contaminated. In response to these allegations, former Chief Superintendent George Nedley denied mishandling the crime scene. Retired Detective Inspector James Goldie also refuted claims that a blanket had ever been placed over Elaine's body. He clarified that blankets had been hung on the fence to obscure the view, but he maintained that no blanket had covered her. Defense attorney Finley countered this, calling it a potentially catastrophic blunder by the police at the scene, and insinuating that evidence would support the presence of a blanket over Elaine. Subsequently, retired Detective John Wilson provided testimony regarding the blanket. He maintained that he had never witnessed a blanket covering Elaine's body. However, the defense team then presented a statement he had made back in 2012, where he had said, "I definitely saw the body covered with a prisoner's blanket." In response, John Wilson expressed doubt, stating, "I don't think I would have said that, to be honest." He accused Strathkye police of manipulating his words. Defense attorney Finley accused police of conducting a cover-up over the inquiry into Lane's murder. Ex-detective John O'Neill said he wasn't sure whether Elaine had been covered with a blanket. However, in 2012, he had told officers he remembered the idea being discussed that Elaine should be covered up. He accused those officers of sowing doubts in his mind. Defense attorney Finley responded, "When you mention the blanket on the body, amnesia flows through the veins like a disease." According to former Detective Chief Inspector William Clark, the crime scene had in fact been contaminated. He said that he was awestruck when he saw the body of Elaine was covered by a blanket. He testified, "The body had been contaminated to a certain extent by the blanket." Former Chief Inspector William Clark agreed. He testified that Elaine's body was covered by a blanket, but back in 2012 he said there was no blanket. Keith Enyon, a former head of forensic support with Strathkye Police, testified next. He explained how he had used adhesive tape to collect any potential hair or fibres from Elaine's body. When prosecutor John Scullion inquired, Enyon acknowledged that the sticky tape could also pick up microscopic elements such as dried blood, skin cells, or other cellular material that might not be visible to the naked eye. The defense team then introduced Alexander Cannon, the individual who had falsely confessed Julian's murder in 2011. According to a psychiatrist, he was suffering from severe mental health problems at the time. Following this, Elaine's friend, Lynn, who'd been with her at the disco, took the stand. She discussed the man in the car that had followed Elaine on multiple occasions. The testimony then shifted to Lynn's husband, Francis McCurdy. Surprisingly, it was revealed that he was on the list of potential suspects in the case. Lynn and her sister, Debbie, had informed detectives that the composite sketch of the suspect bore a resemblance to Francis. Nevertheless, Lynn testified that during their 22 years together, he had never exhibited behaviour or made statements that would lead her to suspect him in Elaine's murder. By now, Francis was deceased. Among the list of potential suspects was also Bernard Bradley, a teenager at the time who had been seen dancing with Elaine at the disco. Bernard testified and said that suggestions he killed Elaine were ridiculous. He said that after the disco, one of his friends drove him home and he went straight to bed. Elaine's own brother, John, took to the witness stand to deny that he was the killer as well. Much like Bernard, he said that suggestions he was involved were ridiculous. A number of other persons of interest that the defence had named testified during the trial as well. Each of them denied any involvement in Elaine's murder. Among them was Colin McIntyre, who had confessed to the murder more than 27 years ago. He testified that he had made the confession after detectives threatened him with violence. He maintained that he was at home at the time of Elaine's murder, watching television with his family. He testified, "The more I was denying it, the more angry they were getting. The more angry they were getting, the more scared I was getting." There was also Alan Cleary, who had gave detectives at the time a false alibi. On the witness stand, he said that he had simply made a terrible error of judgment. Defense attorney Finley said to him, "What kind of man does this unless he had something to hide? An evil man." Another suspect was Bram Buckley, who was serving a life sentence for killing a mother of two in Wales in 2010. Doherty's defense team tried to argue that there were similarities between the two cases, causing Buckley to have an outburst on the witness stand. All the other men who were named as persons of interest, there was no evidence to connect any of them to Elaine's murder. John Doherty, on the other hand, was connected to the murder with DNA. Forensic scientist Terence Randall said that over the years she ran more advanced testing on the samples taken from Elaine's face, body and legs. Finally, she found male DNA on her face and back that had come from the same person. The DNA had gotten onto Elaine's back after she was strangled from behind. The DNA was remarkable evidence because it was found on Elaine's nude body as opposed to on her clothing. Fiona McMahon, head of the DNA database team at the police lab, testified that Doherty's DNA came back as a full match to that DNA profile. Fiona testified that she had collected samples from most of the other persons of interest that the defence had named during the trial, yet none of them matched the DNA at the crime scene. Forensic scientist Pauline McSorley then told the jury that it was more than a billion times more likely that the DNA profile found on Elaine had come from Doherty more than any other unrelated male. She said that if the DNA had gotten there as Elaine danced in the club with somebody, then she would have expected to recover it from her blouse, but she didn't. After the prosecution rested, the defence began their case. They once more mentioned the car that had followed Elaine several times in the lead-up to her murder. They called on Samantha Nicol, who said she was in Ardgowan Street in the early morning hours of the 2nd of June 1986. She said that she saw a man walking up and down the street in the hours before Elaine's body was discovered. She said that she didn't recognise him. After her testimony, the trial came to an end. Prosecutor John Scullion said during his closing arguments that they had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that John Doherty was guilty. He reminded the jury of the DNA evidence and the eyewitnesses, including Martin identifying him as the angry man following Elaine, and Doherty's ex-fiancée, who described his outburst when she asked him why he wasn't talking to police. He said to the jury, "I would invite you to consider that each individual piece of evidence combines to build a clear, powerful and compelling case." Defense attorney Donald Finley, on the other hand, accused detectives of not properly securing the crime scene. He said that the way they had acted caused evidence to become contaminated. Therefore, he said that the DNA evidence against Dougherty was unreliable. The jury were then sent off to deliberate. The crux of the case was whether they believed that the DNA evidence was reliable or not. They deliberated for just a couple of hours before returning with a verdict. They found John Dougherty guilty of the murder of Elaine Doyle. Finally, justice had been served, but it was bittersweet for Elaine's family. They had waited so long for this moment, and Jack wasn't there to witness it. Elaine's brother John commented, "I kept asking why us, why this family. Now I just wish my dad was alive to see this verdict. He wanted so much for this day to come, and he would have been happy with the outcome." John Dougherty was subsequently sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 21 years. In 2016, however, he appealed to have his conviction quashed. His defense attorney, Donald Finley, told the Court of Appeal, "Beyond a shadow of a doubt, there has been a miscarriage of justice." He said that the question was how a microscopically small sample of Dougherty's DNA came to be on Elaine's body. He also accused the jury of being overly and unreasonably influenced by the existence of the DNA. The appeal was denied. The wheels of justice may have turned slowly, but with the remarkable advancements in DNA technology and forensic science, justice was no longer an elusive dream. Jack and Maureen Doyle had tirelessly championed the cause of justice for their beloved daughter, Elaine. Yet despite their unwavering determination, Jack passed away without witnessing justice being served. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. And I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new supporter up on Patreon, Scott. If you'd like to support Morbidology up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. Or you can just download the app or go on desktop and search for Morbidology. In exchange for your support, I upload bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast feeds. I'm just about to record the next episode, which covers the disturbing murder of 4-year-old Sabrina Clement. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, video, and case files, and I send out some cool exclusive merch along with a handwritten thank you card. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. It helps to keep independent shows running and free to consume. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.